I'm Glenn Gersmill, and we're going to look today first at seeing where local peacemaking fits into the larger picture of peacemaking in the country, briefly, then open up into discussion of some issues that we've been brainstorming here before we started. Thirdly, to go at somewhat systematically the issue of peacemaking on the parish or community level in terms of some of the pragmatic aspects based on what I've spent most of my time doing, and that is either working on a grassroots level with a group or on a state or countrywide level coordinating efforts that are picked up then by grassroots groups. So I've seen it from both ends. Another period of discussion after that, and finally we'll conclude with some comments on resources for carrying on what we're talking about here. So, beginning with the larger picture, I think a couple of the lessons that we can learn from the post-war period of peacemaking is that there's an inevitable rise and fall of at least media tension and as well numbers of people involved and at least perceived enthusiasm for work on various issues, and that if we're aware of these sorts of cycles, the ebb and flow of energies, it can help those of us who are in it for the long haul on a lifelong level to roll with the punches and not see it as failure when things tail off. And in fact, probably the more important work happens in the troughs rather than the peaks, because at that point you're usually dealing with the more committed, the people who see, despite the fact that the media isn't talking about it, that peacemaking and social justice are important, and those are the leaders. That's the spirit that will carry the peaks when you get out of the valley. So that's a really a crucial period of any struggle. Interesting perspective, I think, and useful, you know, because there's so much from the outside that's saying the opposite. Another thing, as I mentioned, there have been 60 or 70 major conflicts since World War II. We have listed only a few here. And finally, that there is a lot to be hopeful about in terms of the sweep of events now in the peacemaking movement. There's been a tremendous growth of the number of groups and involved in peace, as well as groups that aren't defined explicitly as peace groups, taking on peace as one of their top priorities. The final point I guess I'd like to make here is that much of what has happened in the early 80s are really contradictory. That is, the same event, there is both a really hopeful, positive side and a challenging, problematic side too. For example, the MX and Contra Aid fights in Congress. In effect, we won both of them in the fall. 1985 money was not allocated last year in the spring and summer budgetary cycle, nor in the fall period. Both were delayed until this year, so that the votes that we lost this year were $1985 dollars, not 1986. And when they actually did come up with a vote, while the actual vote was a loss, there is reason for hope on two levels. Number one, the votes were very close. Number two, the administration had to put immense pressure. They had to cash in political chips that are lost now. The administration does not have the power to repeatedly do what they had to do to win those two votes. And finally, they got a good bit less than they wanted. The MX missile plan was for 200 missiles, and it wasn't an inflated figure that Reagan was hoping to get fewer. He wanted 200. It was cut back to 100, and now it's clear it'll be more in the range of 50. And that's a significant victory. The same with the, in fact, even more so on the budget. Reagan originally wanted in the neighborhood of 7 or 8% real growth in defense spending this year to keep up with and pay for all of the decisions that were made in the last 4 years. He was willing to settle for 6 at the turn of the year, for 3% went in the negotiations with the Senate, and we're down to 0% at this point. We're talking about a freeze with adjustment only for inflation. And that's a real significant fall off in the wake of the scale of the presidential victory that we saw last fall. And polls support that many people who voted for Reagan and support Reagan as a president are opposed to significant numbers of his policies. And I think it's useful to remember that the opposition is not a monolithic, all-powerful opposition, but that in fact we can win substantial gains on the political arena. Just one final example of that, the freeze resolution, which came into Congress a few months after the UN special session opened June 11th and the largest peace march in our country's history on June 12th of 1982. That fall, I believe it was August, Congress discussed and ultimately rejected by 2 or 3 votes the freeze resolution. So that it was a deep disappointment. It was at the tail end of a really mammoth amount of work on our part, but the narrowness of the victory did indicate that we had something going, and I might say that's the start-off point for one of the books that is attempting to say where we're going, Drinan's book, Beyond the Nuclear Freeze. I think there's stuff that's newer than this that's important to read, but that's kind of an interesting one to skim through at the very least. And he called that vote a real turning point. We're either going to blossom or die in terms of the future of the movement. Okay, and it's that sort of challenge and problematic dichotomy that I think is real important for us to be aware of. There's both reason for hope and there's reason for work. And you know, one of the interesting things about Scripture is that Christ is constantly tailoring the gospel to the hearer. To one, he says, my burden is indeed light. And to another, my cross is heavy. And so that whichever side of that dichotomy needs to be heard by the people you're working with is the one you say, and at the same time being aware of or vocalizing the other. But oftentimes we need to emphasize one or the other side of either the hopefulness or the importance of us putting out the energy that we need to. Okay, let's take a look then, moving into the second part of today's work, some of the questions that were raised before the session began. How do you answer the question of, isn't it un-American to be against the bomb or against our involvement with the Contras in Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera? Let's throw it out for the group discussion.
Define un-American, and then I think we can go from there. What do we consider un-American?
Okay. How about it's un-American if it's against the best interests of our country? That's not a bad idea to define that or ask for a definition of that. People have different ideas, or people may have a definition that really precludes the answer, at least as we see it.
Well, that implies that to be American, the flip side is America first. And whatever is in the, quote, national security interest of this country, we can shelve human rights or any principles that were founded upon.
Uh-huh.
Further what Pastor Weinberger says is interest.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In a democracy, we're all entitled to our opinions and feelings and expressions.
I would say that, and I think I'd go a step further. It may be in our short-range interest to do some of the things we're doing in the name of national security, but I would say that it's against our long-term interests to prop up dictatorships or attempt to undermine elected governments elsewhere in the world. If we're in favor of democracy, it doesn't serve our long-term interests, and not to mention our long-term credibility, to be seen voting for funds to create and then ultimately support a force that whose purpose is to undermine an elected democracy, no matter how we dislike it.
For me, being American is this can't be the first priority in my life. I have too many other things that are, I have citizenship in too many other areas to narrow myself to only what's best for this particular group of people.
Okay, that's a really powerful approach. I'm a citizen of the world, or more strongly, I'm a citizen of God's earth. I happen to be an American. I may be proud to be an American, but that's not my first priority in terms of defense of a particular institutional framework.
This doesn't exactly fit, but it's in the same ballgame. I heard a lecture not too long ago on National Public Radio say the most un-American, the most unpatriotic statement, and he was an economist, by the way, that was ever perpetrated on the American people was "buy America." Said if you want to kill America quick economically, then this is your slogan, "buy America." And he thought he was being very patriotic in saying that.
I think we can say that even more strongly with some of the things that defense spending has often been defended on the basis that it helps our economy. And there's been a very powerful series of books and articles by one of the really preeminent resources that if you don't know of now, you need to know of, and that's this Council on Economic Priorities in New York. It's in the resources list. Which stresses that, in fact, defense spending is really undermining our economy in a number of ways. It's making us less competitive to our trading partners in Europe and Japan. Compared with the way things were even in the Second World War, most defense research is in areas that won't have the same spin-off in terms of our local economy. It's draining away our best brains into developing technology that doesn't have the commercial payoff that it once did. And in a number of other areas, is really undermining our economic security. So that even apart from the national security question, there are real questions that can be raised about both the level of defense spending in our economy and the shape of it, the nature of where that money is going.
A very simple resource that states that very well is the book published here at Holden Village by Dan Erlander called "A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb." He just makes that point very well as a lot of other related points in a way that's very accessible to people of all age levels and of all levels of expertise.
Yeah, one of the more interesting books, we talked about constituencies that are developing resources that speak to each of their own needs. Harold Willens has written a book aimed at business executives, and in fact, there are several organizations for peace comprised of business executives of major corporations who share the point of view that we're articulating here. How business executives can help solve the nuclear weapons crisis, and they have a really important role. And it's a big mistake. I hear periodically people saying that it's us, the people, against the corporations. And that's really a mistake, both because we're all in it together and because there are important resources and insights that people from different places in society have. There are generals that I think are clearly, you know, not only for peace, which I think most generals are, but have a kind of insight into what needs to be done that is really valuable for our work. So the Trimtad Factor by Harold Willems is a real helpful piece there. Let's take just a few minutes on this issue, and I think the others will be picked up in the next section. Is a conventional buildup necessary as a step toward disarmament? What about the Soviet threat? Here there are a couple resources in the leaflet that I want to draw your attention to. One is called Dubious Specter. It's a skeptical look at the Soviet nuclear threat. Another, Questions and Answers on the Soviet Threat and National Security. The first by Fred Kaplan, an Institute for Policy Studies publication. The second published by American Friends Service Committee. I might mention a couple others. There's one called The Threat by Alexander Coburn. It's a really widely known defense expert. There are several others that have come out. And what they all do is help us interpret the numbers that were constantly being fed by the proponents of a massive defense buildup that say that we need to equal the Soviet threat. And there's several real serious flaws in the reasoning that that say this. And I'll just summarize three or four of them. First of all, the Soviet Union has a very different concept of what the shape of an armed force ought to be, based on the fact that two-thirds of the casualties of World War II were Soviet citizens, and a similar proportion of the First World War. And one of the expressions of that in Soviet military doctrine is that they have often won when they have been able to overwhelm the opposition. Germans oftentimes were willing to suffer 4-1 losses in the air against Germany, but knowing that they had the capacity to simply overwhelm the German Air Force in the skies enabled them to succeed. They did a little better on tanks and artillery, which was always a strength of the Soviets and still is. Ultimately, they were able to match the German threat and simply crushed it, rolled over the German armed forces. The other piece of their, so that they always will see parity as having more numbers. And it's a fact of military life that in fact our quality has always been greater than the Soviets, even in the most pessimistic comparisons, in 14 out of 16 or 17 ways that we compare the two countries' military power. And I'm talking about CIA estimates, not a peacenik version of it. Secondly, the Soviets never throw anything away. There's always the feeling that they may just be able to come up with the extra manpower to throw into a few extra tanks and go to war with it. So that the Soviet and Warsaw Pact outnumbering of the West 3-1 or 4-1 in tanks and artillery partly represents a whole lot of decrepit machinery that we wouldn't take into battle anymore. We would phase out or mothball at the least. And secondly, a lower level of quality in some of it, at least. That's changed in some significant departments, but it's, I think, characterized in congressional testimony, where one of the questions that that even the most afraid of our weakness and the fact that we're becoming second best of our generals have been asked the question, would you trade your army in Europe or your flotilla, your task force on the sea for the Soviet counterpart? And the answer has never been yes. And in fact, they'd be dumb to. In a whole lot of really significant ways, we outclass the Soviet Union. There's certainly ways that we're weak. If you look at it on a scale, if money were no object, what could we have? But the other thing is that, and it's particularly important when you talk about strategic weapons, the nuclear ICBMs and so forth, the United States has consistently chosen, as a matter of policy, as a superior way of acting, to build smaller warheads. So that when you see we have the same number of delivery vehicles or the same number of warheads, but they have so much larger throw weight or a megatonnage, we could easily put larger, bombs on top of our missiles, but we find that it's more effective to have more accurate missiles, and there is at least the chance that we won't blow up the world if we ever have to use them. I think most of us aren't willing to risk it anyway, but the United States has consistently made a policy decision to have smaller, more accurate missiles compared with Soviet missiles. Our final area is in combat readiness. There have been just numerous reports, both from CIA sources and from people like Coburn, who've interviewed hundreds of former military people from the Soviet Union who have been emigres, And as you know, they tend to be on the conservative side of things when they get over, you know, just like Cuban emigres in Florida don't tend to be pro-Cuba anymore. And the story that is built up by really systematic interviewing of people from the armed forces or observation of Soviet exercises is that the state of Soviet equipment is really pretty abysmal. They frequently can't get two-thirds of their tanks rolling when they have a yearly exercise. Their fighter pilots spend a quarter of the number of hours in the air compared with U.S. fighter pilots in terms of training. We keep more than half of our ships afloat. 15% of Soviet ships are afloat at a given time out doing exercises and running around because the equipment simply wouldn't stand up for more than that level of activity. It'd fall apart. There are several Soviet tanks that are so cramped that a Soviet tanker would be simply unable to fight after a couple hours of driving around in it. There are a lot of ways in which Soviet equipment is really inferior. Their assumption is that their equipment would break down so severely that they spend a small fraction of the amount of energy that we do on logistics and repair and keeping things operative. Their assumption is that they would pile into a conflict and after a few weeks, a good proportion of their equipment simply wouldn't be running anymore, and they would have transferred to other kinds of equipment. So, is that three over? Okay.
Well,
some timekeepers there.
Are you saying then that the picture that, that we seem to get from the media that at best NATO could hold the Soviets for 3 to 4 days in West Germany before we would either have to make major adjustments in conventional warfare or we would have to resort to nuclear weapons? Is that just a fallacy?
Well, first of all, even our current doctrine doesn't attempt to hold it. We have a new air-land doctrine, I think it's called, and I forget the name of it, but what it represents is deep penetration into the rear echelons and destruction of massive amounts of the communication, command and control. C-cubed is what they talk about it in the military journals. So that, in the first place, we're not going to attempt to hold a line. We will do that, but we will also be creating havoc behind the lines. And our superiority in cruise missiles, it could even be conventional cruise missiles at first, would make a mess, a mincemeat out of an already overly centralized system of running an army. You may have heard the story, and it's still largely true, for example, in Soviet tank forces, that in a battalion of tanks, only one radio can both receive and send, and that's the commander's radio. All of the other radios can only receive. They have an entirely different way, what they call military doctrine, way of fighting a war. And it doesn't make them less of a threat. I would not want to be in Germany, you know, in an invasion. And in fact, they might very well be able to penetrate very deeply. They have a very aggressive style of fighting a war. But I think the truth is that it's a very small percentage of Soviet online commanders who are agitating for an invasion of Germany. And frankly, maybe we can debate this afternoon, I think it's one of the less likely scenarios of the start of a Third World War that there'll be an invasion in Central Europe. I think the Soviet Union, having suffered the losses they did in World War II, knows that it would set their economy back 20 years even if they won. I think it's an unlikely scenario, and I think most strategists do think it's an unlikely scenario of the beginning of World War III. If World War III were to start because of something in the Middle East or an accident, etc., it wouldn't surprise me that Central Europe would go and be one of the first areas to go. But I think that the fact is the strength of NATO is significant enough, particularly when you take all of the bases and all of the depth that the United States and NATO has in terms of a response, there isn't a chance. that's an exaggeration. It's unlikely those tanks are going to go rolling across the line. So that our efforts ought much more be directed to getting together with the Soviet Union and talking about the stalemate that exists, even while I'm I'm confident that it will be years before we're going to get the United States to significantly cut back on development of new weapons, so that that's going to continue, peace movement or no peace movement. We've got to get to the bargaining table and talk Turkey with the Soviet Union and say, look, you know, we're both in putting serious strains on our economy with this level of defense spending. Let's figure out a way that we can retain a certain amount of parity and cut back. And the Soviet Union will be willing to do it.
So you would not advocate, in terms of, again, I'm trying to get a practical policy, if our congressman is making a pitch for substituting $1 billion per MX missile for more tanks, yeah, or more personnel or something, that is not a worthwhile alternative, and that's not a step towards peace. I hear the growing
right,
reliance upon tactical nuclear weapons that will make a nuclear strike
more likely. Yeah, I think. I mean, I haven't looked at this close enough for me to be willing to give a real solid answer on it. But at the minimum, I would say the likelihood is that we would redirect some of that money toward conventional readiness in particular. One of the curiosities of the Reagan administration's handling of military policy, and it's, I think, another critique of the Reagan administration's military policy, is that, in fact, a slightly smaller number of U.S. units are ready, equipped with ammunition supplies, et cetera, now than when Reagan entered office. Even though that was one of the principal critiques that he made of Carter, he has put the bulk of the energy, as most presidents do, into fancy new hardware and expansion rather than... there are several ships that don't have enough shells for their full complement, and when they come back in and their sister ship goes back out, they have to lift the shells off of ship A and put them into ship B so that it has enough to be able to go out and feel like it's ready to meet any eventuality. And it's that kind of nuts and bolts behind the scenes kind of defense expenditure that even the Reagan administration has sacrificed to be able to buy a lot of new weaponry.
Isn't one of the frightening things related to Eastern Europe, if a conventional war were to start, that the placement of the weapons on both sides of the lines are such that you get in a use them or lose them position with your nuclear weapon?
Yeah. I'm told, I've talked to a number of people in the military about that, and I'm told that we have provisions for disabling with conventional explosives, backpack bombs. That's the 65-pound bomb that people can carry around on their back. Now talk about a frightening piece of machinery lying around somewhere. Or tactical nuclear shells, an 8-inch gun, or I think it's a 155-millimeter howitzer that's the same size. We have nuclear weapons that small. Yeah, get it away from me. Yeah, that's a scary thing, and I don't frankly believe that we have that problem licked, that they would fall into Soviet hands. But I think the scale of any serious clash on that border would be such that there would be other equally horrifying realities, you know, that would be facing us. And as far as the lose 'em and use 'em, in fact, I don't trust our policymakers to not push the button if we get into a bad situation. But, you know, that I think it's important to not overstate in a Dr. Strangelove kind of a way how rabidly interested in fighting a nuclear war our own military is. You know, you read the debates of military commanders about how to handle different scenarios or the simulation games that they play repeatedly, you know, the war games. They're always very, very reluctant to go nuclear. So that I think there's a certain amount of hope that we can take from the fact that in reality there are human beings out there in the military, and they may have a certain narrowness of vision that we would like to broaden on some levels. But on the bottom line, there are a lot of very caring, committed to peace generals and colonels and commanders out there that makes it unnecessary for us to exaggerate and to have a really inaccurate and non-productive image of what we have in our armed forces. I am much more afraid of policy decisions that leave us in a situation of lose 'em or use 'em than I am that we have some gung-ho types that are eager to press the button, which is, I think, a really dangerous, damaging, unnecessary, and misleading projection that we often give within the peace movement. Not all of it or much of it even, but too much do we hear that. And it's inaccurate. It's in fact, and it scares me because of that, because some people aren't really reading the literature that's available, if that's their picture that they paint of our military. Yeah?
I'm just real uncomfortable with the whole discussion about the last 10 minutes because of an analysis of who's going to be able to kill who on which side and which side is going to come out winning in the war and everything. What I'm most concerned with is that I and my country are preparing to kill all of these people, whoever they are, and I don't care what they're doing toward me. I don't want to be preparing to kill them. Yeah. And so on that basis, the nuclear, conventional, whatever, why are we spending all this money getting ready to kill all these people?
I purposely took that tack because I think it's a less discussed reality to put ourselves in the shoes of Soviet and U.S. on the field military commanders. It was the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff that unanimously told Reagan to pull the Marines out and that he should never have put the Marines in Beirut in the first place. It was the Joint Chiefs that have been one of the restraining pieces in terms of invasion of Nicaragua. But to come to grips with the point you're making, I think there is perhaps even a more powerful, and at least with some people, argument, and that is that even if the Soviet Union were to launch nuclear missiles on the United States or use a tactical nuclear weapon, do we want our country to, even in that case, use a nuclear weapon? And I think that's a kind of an interesting question to pose. And at first I answered yes. I guess my conservative, politically conservative upbringing kind of came through and the sort of, high school football mentality that says we've got to fight back and all the rest. But the more I've thought about it, the more in my heart of hearts, it would be better for a few American cities to go up in flames and even capitulation of some form or another than to have the stain on our character of matching a Soviet nuclear weapon with an American nuclear weapon. The irony, of course, is that the Soviet Union has taken a stand committing itself to no first use of nuclear weapons, and we haven't. But I think that's a really valuable piece that you've raised. I think what I said earlier is another angle on that same argument that for some people is the only one they're able to hear. A lot of people coming out of the Second World War mentality when I think it's really arguable that it was necessary for the United States to have gotten involved in that war to the scale we did and to beat the Nazis on the military battlefield. That's at least arguable. Christians are divided on that one more than they are on the question you're raising, and consequently it can be a useful piece of it to read up on and to be able to talk to people on their terms, to understand how they view national security, and to say, you can be for peace and for security even along your lines.
I think that builds on itself, so that accepts a viewpoint that the military and the violent way is the way to go. And because of that, then we keep reassessing how much strength we have and we always
right.
want more. That's not useful to peace.
Right. For that reason, I would never give that argument in isolation from the larger argument. I would always say, okay, let's take it from your definition of national security. And even in those terms, it doesn't make sense to have a continued buildup. It doesn't make sense militarily, it doesn't make sense strategically, and it certainly doesn't make sense in terms of our economy and the strength, our real strength, which is, from many people's point of view, economic and spiritual. But thank you for that, because you're right. Mm-hmm. One final comment, and we'll move on.
I just think that point that
that he's making is really well summed up by John Howard Yoder. He says, because I'm a follower of Jesus, there's all sorts of causes for which I would die, but there aren't any causes for which I would kill.
Okay. He has a really striking book called When War is Unjust, and several other writings that address that topic. Okay. Let's move on to the discussion of peacemaking on a parish or community level. I'm going to be talking very practically. As I mentioned earlier, I've spent the better part of my life as a community organizer or coordinator of either grassroots groups that are working on peace or coordinating statewide or national campaigns working for various issues. And one of the first principles, I think, of working on that level, let me backtrack one step. Let me first address the problems that I hear most often from parish or community groups that are working on peace. And I've done really a lot of consulting or training with several hundred groups around the country, some dozen states, in both peace and social justice issues. So I've had an awful lot of chance to hear. And the kinds of questions that I hear most when I say, what are the problems, what are the difficulties you face, are these. Number one, it feels like I'm doing everything myself. I can't seem to get people to get involved in the project that I'm proposing. Or I hear reports of signs of poor morale. People are late all the time, or they miss meetings, or they don't do tasks they said they would, or they fall off in terms of their interest, and then it's a smaller and smaller group in a given period. Or that it's hard to maintain the spirit. It's hard to keep positive and enthusiastic, or it's a corollary. What we do is so insignificant, how can it matter? And so what I'm going to be presenting is in part in response to those kinds of problems that groups face, and I'm talking about groups whether they're working on housing, health, peace, or the church building fund. The first principle that I think we need to work on or to put in front of our eyes and our activity is getting to know the people that are in our group or in our project itself. There's no substitute for knowing how the members of our group or the potential members of our group think and operate and what excites them, what moves them. One of the exciting aspects of a number of the organizing manuals that are coming out, I picked up the Handbook for World Peacemaker Groups in the library over here, for example, is the stress that's laid on this very point, that it's better to start with what are the gifts, what are the strengths of your group, and then to see where you can go with that, than for us to cook up the project first and then approach people to see if we can get them to do specific tasks. Ultimately, it becomes a little of both, of course, but even the choosing of the project or the way you cut a given issue and the direction you're going to move is going to be based on the real strengths and gifts and enthusiasms of the people that we're working with on the local level. Make sense? One of the ways of, I think, doing that is to ask the question for yourself, what is the next step for this group of people? And in fact, to ask it individually. One of the disciplines that I demand of myself and of people that I've supervised, like Vista Volunteers, which I worked with and trained for several years, half a dozen at a time, was to go down the list of the individuals in the group and to say, where are they at? Where is the enthusiasm? What are the limitations? What kind of work do this person hate to do? Where are their best strengths, etc.? To be thinking as clearly as we can among ourselves as a core leadership group and as well individually with the person. I think everyone likes to feel that a leader is concerned not just with getting their shtick done, but with me. You know, where am I going with my life? What would be the next step for me in growing as a peacemaker, as a Christian? And that can't happen without building relationships. Peacemaking is above all building solid relationships with people that respect them and that are open to them and that aren't so urgent about getting some particular task done that we lose sight of the goal of the whole thing, which is a human society. And the cliche from the 60s, the personal is the political, I think is correct within that kind of framework. I think a corollary to that is to get rolling a flow of ideas. Part of building a spirit in a group is that everybody's sort of cooking, everybody is thinking. By asking the question of what is your next step, the whole group is thinking about where they're moving, what would be exciting, what kind of project would be worth my best efforts. One of the little placards that we used to share with one another and hang on our refrigerators and walls and mirrors was actually started by a New Yorker cartoon, really funny one. So this king with a little crown holding this little box with a ribbon that was aside from it and saying delightedly, "Why, this is a gift fit for me." This is a challenge worthy of me. This is a challenge worthy of my best efforts and my best talents. That's the kind of direction that will set things hopping. And part of that is a kind of a brainstorming mentality of having a flow of ideas. Linus Pauling put it really well. In order to have a lot of good ideas, you need to have a lot of ideas. And I think that's true in several other dimensions too. I think there ought to be a flow of ideas in terms of newsletters and sharing of information. As hard as it is to have meetings that get done on time, I think part of every meeting ought to be sharing of some piece of information from the broader picture of the peace movement. Otherwise, in the longer term, you're gonna stagger. And that would be where I would very strongly suggest subscribing to a few of the newsletters of the groups listed here, like Council on Economic Priorities in terms of materials on domestic aspects, or Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, or Center for Defense Information, the one that I mentioned, that headed by several generals and other high-ranking former military officers that produces such a marvelous set of materials. The same is true in terms of events and meetings in the community. If there's a conference that's going to be held in your community or nearby, or a rally or march, what I used to have as a rule for VISTA volunteers was don't go anywhere alone. And what that meant was you calling up other people in one's group a week or two before it, and as a peer say, "Hey, you know, there's going to be a really exciting event coming up, and let's go together. We can sit in the back and sort of kibitz and talk about the style of the way the meeting's chaired or how we would do it different." And there, what it turns out to be is a learning experience, a way of getting a flow of ideas not only within your own head, but out in the group. Another one of those principles that we used to have was that a meeting ought to take place on the table, not in your head. So many chair people act as though the meeting is really up here, and that's all the further they plan it. A meeting ought to be planned so that it's out there, you know, with everyone with their hands into the effort. Does this make sense in terms of constructing the way in which effective peacemaking goes on in our local level? I see a few heads nodding. Let's take the next step when we get into actual activities and projects. I'm on to remembering the rules that we used to use and still use in terms of organizing. Another one is nothing builds commitment like work. Putting people to work within the first few weeks after they get involved in a group whose purpose is action, not other levels, is the way to build commitment and strength in an operation. And so that your projects or activities are really important and need to be planned carefully and effectively. There's a sign on the Alaska Highway, choose your rut carefully, you'll be on it for the next 200 miles. Another rule for planning meetings and activities that we used to observe, there's a tendency to wing it a lot in small groups. And in fact, the small group is more important than the larger group, right? The small action group is more important than the big meeting. It goes against the media-defined image of leadership, but it's very true. I think the point is, just I can see from our timekeeper that I'm going to need to pick things up here, to pick issues that are going to really move people forward, that are going to both be winnable and exciting and encourage people in terms of the issue and help strengthen the group. And one of the mistakes that people make, well, actually there's a two-sided mistake, either in not making the issue fun enough or in not making it serious enough. Serious people aren't going to want to mess around with a project that's superficial. You want to have an activity or project that's really worth taking time away from something else. So many leaders plan meetings as though people don't have anything else to do. And the fact is that you need to plan activities and meetings with the awareness that people are going to have to drop something else, cut their supper shorter, eat a fast food supper, not spend some moments with the children, etc. And we need to plan carefully enough to have effective and powerful enough activities that people, it's worth their time to come out. And that's the point when you'll get people that are able to really contribute, because they know the difference between effective and ineffective activities. This shouldn't surprise you on the basis of what I've just talked about. Audre Lorde has a quote that again is on the back cover of a number of the notebooks that I use and elsewhere. When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less important whether or not I'm afraid. Or Amelia Earhart, the famous flyer, put it, courage is the price that life exacts for granting peace. It really makes sense that if you've done the kind of planning that leads to an effective project, to go for it full speed ahead at that point. There's been enough here that emphasizes the point of looking out for your own needs that I'm not going to dwell on it. But the fact is that if you're getting nurturance and strength, both religious and in terms of your balance and your psychological health, you're going to be a whole lot more fun to be around. And in fact, if you really do it right, people are going to be crawling to get into your activity, whether they care about it or not. I've oftentimes had people tell me or people that I've worked with, it actually wasn't the project itself that inspired me, but I just like to work with you. And that's the kind of spirit that you want to create. You want to have people from all of the other committees in your parish or community wanting to be in a project with you because they know it's going to fly. The final tip is a sense of humor. There originally were seven, but this isn't a perfect workshop. So, of course, is that one of the turnoffs for people is that someone who takes themselves too seriously or sees themselves as the center of the world. Was really nicely put on a bit of graffiti I once saw. He who laughs last. No. He who laughs lasts. Is it take off on he who laughs last laughs best. I'm going to hold it there. I guess we'll do any further discussion individually, and we'll keep the tape running to be able to include the information on resources. Why don't we stop for a minute here in case people want to leave, and those of you that want to just take a, I'll make it a 5-minute summary of what some of the resources available are, can stay for a few minutes. So.